Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me here today for this very personal and very important podcast episode. As I mentioned last week, I do have something that is very significant for me to share here on the podcast. For anyone who's listened for a number of years, there's nothing here that is new, but it has just come to the point where I've got to tear off the Band-Aid and kind of share all of this again, get back into all of it again, because of the reality that I face in terms of what has been done to me and the abuse that I have suffered. And it's just reached a point of being unbearable because there's a wall around me out there, and I do what I can to break that wall down, but it's a pretty solid wall. And so I'm sharing all of this in the hopes that people will take the time to listen, to consider what I'm sharing, to approach it with an open mind, and hopefully feel inspired to do something about it, to just to be blunt, to help me, that I do need help and I do need assistance. And this is something that I cannot do alone. That has become quite clear. And so I'm sharing all of this again here on my podcast in the hopes that people can listen, can take in what I'm sharing, and hopefully it will inspire others to stand up for what I believe is fairness and justice. And if not, well, that's just the way things roll. But here is my take on what has happened to me over the past couple of years and what I am up against and where I could use some help, some understanding, some compassion, and some honesty. So thank you very much for listening. And if you want to share this with people that you think it might be good for them to hear, then I would appreciate that. And otherwise, as I say in the essay that I'm sharing here, I am always open to speak with people. I am happy to talk about any of these issues that are raised here in this podcast. And I invite that as well, that I'm not trying to hide anything here. I'm just trying to be open, trying to be honest, and most importantly, trying to be accurate. So without any further ado, here is my essay. Thanks again for listening. Be back next week with more regularly scheduled programming here on the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. My Scarlet Letter. Living with the aftermath of Symposia's unethical journalistic abuse. Towards the end of the summer of 2016, I made the decision to retire from my practice of being what I'd come to call a non-dual energetic practitioner. I hadn't consciously set out to give my practice a name. It was clear that my practice didn't fit into any previous categories, and there was no one else on the planet that I was aware of that was working in a similar mode with a similar methodology. In the world of facilitation of psychedelic experience, I wasn't offering ceremony, I wasn't offering psychedelic-assisted therapy, and it was a far cry from being a mere provider of psychedelic experience or trip-sitter. So, what to call it? I landed on non-dual energetic therapy, as it was a practice of helping clients encounter, release, and transform the limiting energetic structures and habits of embodied expression and reaction to facilitate a non-dual encounter with the universal self. It was therapy in the sense that it wasn't about singular experiences, but an ongoing process of uncovering the authentic self, hidden beneath layers of egoic narratives, identities, and conceptualizations, as embodied through patterned energetic structures of self-identification and expression. I had very specific and rational guidelines for how this therapy was to proceed, and how interactions between myself as the practitioner and my clients was to occur for maximum benefit. The practice involved both myself and my clients consuming 5-MeO-DMT simultaneously, and then attending authentically to whatever energies arose. I only ever worked one-on-one, meaning I only worked with one client at a time, never working with groups, and for each session, my full and undivided attention was on my client and the immediacy of their experience and energetic processing. Observers and witnesses were often present for these sessions, but they were not part of the session in any sense, and I had clear guidelines for how observers were not to get involved or interfere with the client's experience or my work as the facilitator. Because the work was so demanding, I only did one session a day, though there were a few exceptions where I'd been hired to work with groups of people where I held several sessions a day over the course of a week or more. But this was always one-on-one work. It was not possible to adequately apply this methodology to more than one person at a time. It was too focused, specific, and demanding. The organic growth and creation of this practice was the outcome of my own personal work with entheogens in 2008 and 2009, wherein I underwent a profound process of transformation and energetic reformatting by embracing the non-dual nature of being. Through my own process, I learned how to not only be present with the most profound non-dual energies, but also embody them here and now. This is what I brought to all my sessions with my clients: a profound sense of energetic presence where there was no interference from the limiting, editing, and censoring structures of the ego, just unlimited presence and direct embodiment. While my clients often commented that the work we did together should have been impossible, given the infinitely expansive energy of 5-MeO-DMT, for me, it was always just another day in the office, as I would tell them. But for my clients, they could not fathom how it was that I was able to remain present and focused on them and their experience, and seem to be able to anticipate and be present for their energetic needs as they arose while under the influence of 5-MeO-DMT. However, I had already accepted that all these powerful energies were just myself, and I'd learned how to let go of my egoic structure and simply be present and respond authentically to what was arising as it was arising. Nothing more and nothing less. It's actually quite simple, but the process of getting to this quality of presence is difficult, and I went through a lot to get there. But once I settled into my fundamental nature, it was quite natural, and though demanding, was otherwise straightforward. There was never a plan or an agenda, just being present and authentically embodying and expressing energy as it arose. Because my practice was radically unlike anything that anyone else was offering, I always made sure that any potential client had as complete an understanding of how I operated and why as possible before deciding to work with me. Anyone looking for a ceremony, a shaman, a psychotherapist, or some kind of guided trip sitting was looking in the wrong place. I always made it clear that we, as facilitator and client, would be working together in a profoundly intimate, energetic manner where the illusory boundaries of self and other would blur, intermingle, and often disappear entirely. I also made it clear that it was only possible for me to assist them in this process if they were energetically in a place of trust and openness. Otherwise, the limiting structures of the ego would be in the way, and the best I could offer would be coaching and after-the-fact feedback. But when open, present, and trusting, we could do profound energetic work together. For me, this was my supreme act of service, and made use of everything I had to offer as an individual embodiment of the one universal being, and I would be meeting them as such themselves, for we are all profoundly one. I'll return to discussing this in more detail at the end of this essay. Most of the people I worked with felt that their sessions with me provided them with something they'd never received anywhere else, and considered our sessions together to be a fundamentally unique and rewarding experience. Most of my clients came back multiple times, and some even worked with me over a number of months and even years. When I retired, many of my current clients at the time were disappointed. They knew that they wouldn't be able to get this level of work anywhere else, and hoped that I would make exceptions for them. For the first few years of my retirement, I repeatedly heard from former clients asking if I'd come out of retirement for them, and also fielded many requests from interested individuals who lamented the fact that they were too late to work with me. The general consensus was that I had been offering something unique, profound, and transformative for which there was no real substitute or alternative outlet. My practice had always been based on word of mouth. I didn't advertise and never encouraged anyone to work with me. My personal policy was that if someone asked, I'd inform them as to how I worked and why I practiced as I did, and if they felt like it was a good fit for them and what they were looking for, then we could arrange a session. While I did obliquely reference the fact that I did sessions with clients publicly, I never talked about what it was or how it worked. It wasn't until after I'd retired that I felt that I could be more open and forthcoming about it at the public level, given that it would entail admitting to illegal activity. Prior to retiring, I had included key details of how I worked and what sessions were like in two of my novels. This felt safe to me, as while I was using somewhat autobiographical material, it was set within fantasy and sci-fi worlds. People who had worked with me could read the novels and immediately recognize that I was sharing from my practice, but others wouldn't necessarily know this when reading the stories. I had spoken a couple of times in 2015 about my practice in public. This happened when I was outside of the country, where it felt safer for me to do so, as such talks happened in countries where 5-MeO-DMT was legal, unlike in the United States. At the start of my practice, it was still legal, but was listed as a Schedule I substance in January of 2011. When I was invited by a former client to come down to LA and share about my practice not long after I'd made the decision to retire, I eagerly took the opportunity. There was much that I'd been wanting to share of not only the logic behind my practice, but also of the unusual, surprising, and unexpected things that I'd encountered in my 7 years as a self-described non-dual energetic practitioner. The invitation had come from LAMPS, the Los Angeles Medicinal Psychedelic Society, and was held on the campus of UCLA. The talk itself was attended by a small group of people and lasted almost 3 hours. It was recorded on video and shortly thereafter released on YouTube by LAMPS, where it quickly rose through the ranks to become the second most watched video of me speaking or being interviewed. The video and lecture was in no way obscure, hidden, or otherwise languishing in a YouTube backwater. It was popular and viewed tens of thousands of times. The most common response I got from people who watched that LAMPS video was to send me a request asking if I'd come out of retirement and work with whomever was emailing me. People would tell me that the talk blew their minds, changed their sense of reality and of what was possible, and inspired them that non-dual energetic therapy with 5-MeO-DMT could be much more than just lighting a pipe and shaking a rattle or hitting a singing bowl for someone. It inspired people to realize that there could be a method for truly working with someone in the 5-MeO-DMT space, and that it could be profound and transformative. Viewers were impressed that I clearly knew what I was talking about, and was coming from a perspective that they couldn't find elsewhere, and that I had been someone who was willing to go into difficult and challenging territory with my clients and worked selflessly for their benefit. But I couldn't be coaxed out of retirement. I'd learned what I could from the practice, and rather than directly facilitating, I wanted to focus more on sharing what I'd learned in the hopes that others could apply it for themselves. I personally identify more as a non-dual entheogenic educator, and being a facilitator was never a crucial part of my identity that I needed to continue to pursue. I wasn't attached to it. So, rather than come out of retirement, I felt inspired to write what would become my personal best-selling book, which detailed my approach to working with 5-MeO-DMT, and also clearly articulated the non-dual energetic framework in which it was situated. The book was released in 2017 and continues to be my best-selling book to this day. It is widely regarded by readers as the most comprehensive work about the 5-MeO-DMT experience available, and it is so appreciated precisely because I dove headfirst into the experience with each and every one of my clients, and together we explored and mapped out territory and levels of human experience that had previously never been charted. Many of my readers tell me they feel it's the most important and significant book they've ever read and is used by people around the world as a guidebook to their own process of self-liberation. And then life flowed on, as it tends to do. Though I didn't understand it or see it for what it was at the time. 2018 was a long descent into what would blossom into a full-blown personal medical crisis at the very beginning of 2019. The crisis pulled the rug out from underneath me and my life, and it was a long, slow path to recovery, which is still the case today as I share this. The crisis required me to rebuild my personal and professional life slowly and one step at a time. It wasn't easy and continues to present challenges, but I persevered and focused on what I could do with my now greatly diminished capacity. When Mark Hayden, former executive director for MAPS Canada, contacted me about contributing to a multi-authored book he was working on as a guide for psychedelic facilitators, I was happy to take him up on the opportunity, and it was a welcome step in rebuilding my life. As we worked together, my role morphed from being a contributor to becoming the editor, publisher, cover designer, and forward writer for the project. Our collaboration lasted a number of months, and the project was finalized around the end of 2020. As the book was focused more on a general therapeutic approach to working with psychedelics, and it wasn't my project, it didn't include any of the more advanced specific techniques and approaches detailed in my own books on non-dual energetics. It being written for a general audience and broadly conceived psychedelic therapy, it was meant as a good reference book for those looking to work and practice in the fledgling field of legal and regulated psychedelic therapy. There was nothing in the book that was particularly controversial, edgy, or would be cause for anyone's concern. It was a good general book. Little did I know, when I was working on this project with Mark Hayden, that he was an ongoing target of Symposia, a group of self-described left-wing radicals who have given themselves the mission of holding members of the psychedelic community accountable. Their style of reporting and investigative journalism is basically the creation of media content to get their audience riled up and as upset and righteously indignant as possible, and have very few ethical qualms about how they achieve their desired aims. They play dirty, sling mud, and revel in the fallout of damaged reputations, all for the sake of holding supposed abusers accountable, bolstering their social media cred, and building up their support base and audience. An unbiased and ethical news organization, Symposia is not. Their entire approach is more parasitical than anything else. They thrive on creating controversy, making their targets look as bad as possible, and retain a contingent of experts who work hard to make sure that their audience develops as negative a view of their targets as they can. They're plagued by confirmation bias, projection, and rejection of any information that does not conform to their chosen narrative. They are quick to call people abusers, groomers, anti-Semitic, white supremacists, and more, opting for inflammatory and triggering language over calm, rational, informed, or nuanced discourse. They are active in cancel culture and would like their targets to be deplatformed and unable to participate in wider psychedelic culture, and thus their motive operandi of defamation. And with my work with Mark Hayden on the book project, they found a perfect target with me. In the spring of 2021, Symposia decided that they could use my collaboration on the book with Mark Hayden against him and against me. Prior to Symposia's campaign against me, no one had ever accused me of harming, abusing, or mistreating anyone, either privately or publicly. There were no accusations against me. Both I and my former clients looked back fondly on our work together in the years before I retired. Even in 2021, some former clients were still asking me if I'd come out of retirement to work with them, and I'd get occasional messages from former clients telling me how much they valued our work together. But I had no intention of returning to directly facilitating. I'd been retired for 5 years at that point. So what, exactly, did Symposia have against me? There were no accusations ever made against me. There were no former clients who had come forward with stories of abuse. There were no accounts circulating of anyone who claimed to have been harmed, mistreated, or otherwise hurt or disrespected by me. What they did have was a few comments I'd made in 2016 in the nearly 3-hour-long video recorded by LAMPS. Symposia stripped the comments of all context, editing them down to an 11-minute video, which is blended with 3 other videos of me, none of which were ever cited as sources by Symposia, and repackaged with the title of Martin Ball's Advice for Psychedelic Therapists. In creating this video, Symposia intentionally introduced numerous visual and audio distortions via extreme close-ups on selected parts of my body, altering my voice, and basically doing all that they could to make sure that the video evoked an extreme negative emotional reaction on the part of viewers. In other words, they did everything they could to make me look and sound as bad and revolting as possible through deliberate emotional manipulation and sensationalism. The video promoted a backlash against Symposia for obvious reasons, and they later made a new edit of the video, but also defiantly proclaimed that, quote, "we stand behind the original video." Symposia also produced an article about my so-called abuses, which they tied into their attacks on Mark Hayden and the book we had produced together. The video, which had zero context, and also recontextualized as my advice for psychedelic therapists, was mirrored in the article as though any of this had anything to do with the book Mark and I had produced, which it didn't. Nowhere did Symposia state that these were entirely unrelated, and they also intentionally spoke and wrote about my comments as though they were current and not from a then 5-year-old video of me recounting unusual events that took place in my personal practice of being a non-dual energetic practitioner, something from which I'd been 5 years retired. In other words, they presented all of this as current and as related to the book. The reporting in the article was further problematized simply from its stated purpose of exposing abusive practitioners receiving institutional support. It was Symposia who decided that I was to be labeled as an abusive practitioner without any supporting evidence or testimony. So here they are clearly expressing an opinion and simultaneously creating and reporting on the, quote, news. And when it comes to institutional support, what they are referencing here is entirely unclear. Is LAMPS, which was 2 individuals who organized and hosted my 2016 talk, an institution? Is that what Symposia means? And is allowing me space to speak about my former practice, which no one prior to Symposia's attacks interpreted as abusive, giving support? Or was Symposia trying to convince readers that my work with Mark Hayden, which was an entirely private affair and had zero connection to MAPS Canada in any official capacity, the institution that was supporting me and my abuses, again, their label, which came from my practice of 5 years previous? Is allowing someone to speak inherently a form of support? Is working with a private individual on a private project institutional? Symposia didn't clarify any of this, which is again why none of this counts as investigative journalism. This is manipulation, obfuscation, and commentary and opinion disguised as news, which it clearly isn't. Prior to the release of the article and the video, I'd received an email from the same individual who produced the video asking me questions about the comments I'd made in the original video that they were repackaging but did not inform me of prior to its release. Thinking that I might be dealing with rational and reasonable human beings, I provided Symposia with the PDF document I'd created to send to potential clients when they inquired about having a session with me. My intent was to show them that I fully disclosed how I worked with every potential client prior to arranging a session so that I knew that everyone was fully informed as to how I worked. I further informed Symposia that I would then spend an hour reviewing all these materials with each client before ever beginning a session. I shared this along with sections of my 2017 book that covered much of the same material in order to provide Symposia with context and clear documentation that people who came to work with me knew what to expect and were informed consenting adults. I also shared the PDF with the instructions that it was not for publication or public dissemination and that I was providing it as a professional courtesy. But Symposia doesn't operate in good faith. They then produced yet a third video of their experts dissecting my PDF and determined that I was a sexual predator, a rapist, an abuser, and a groomer who coaxed people into working with him so that he could act out his perverted desires upon them. Several of my previous clients commented on their videos and article, informing Symposia that they were grossly distorting the entire situation and had stripped it of all context. Some even got into contact with members of Symposia via direct messages. They informed me that Symposia basically told them to fuck off, and those who had contact with Symposia's leader described their interaction with him to me as dealing with a sociopath who is immune to evidence, reason, or rational discussion. Of course, at the time, I challenged Symposia. I invited the individual who originally emailed me and created the video and article to come on my podcast and talk about it and answer my questions. I also offered to come on their podcast to discuss the issues they raised. The response I got back from Symposia was, "We will not be joining you on your platform and will not be having you on ours." A few members of the psychedelic community came to my defense publicly throughout all this. Each and every one was immediately attacked and smeared by Symposia. Others told me personally that they wanted to come to my defense, but were afraid of what Symposia would do to them, as Symposia clearly had no qualms about trashing anyone who dared to challenge their constructed narrative, and facts and actual evidence seemed to have no bearing on how they chose to smear people publicly. Some of my former clients also commented publicly about Symposia's actions and mischaracterization of myself and my practice. Many of them were told that they must have Stockholm Syndrome. Symposia's campaign of manufactured outrage spread like wildfire across the internet and effectively went viral. Symposia had been amazingly successful in weaponizing the second most popular video of me on the internet, which had never caused an uproar or backlash, and turned it against me. Messages and comments poured in from all over the world. I was a psychopath, a deviant, a groomer, an abuser, a rapist. I should be locked up. I should be made a registered sex offender. I shouldn't be allowed around children. And several that were simply, "I hope you die." My house got vandalized. I was immediately pulled from lineups at events where I was scheduled to speak. People told me that they were taking down prior interviews I'd given as they didn't want to court controversy, despite there not being anything of controversy in the removed interviews. Throughout it all, only one person was willing to platform me to give me an opportunity to respond to Symposia. That was Rob Bateman of the Adeptus Psychonautica podcast. In addition to interviewing me about the fiasco, he also produced a video called Symposia vs. Martin Ball, Irrational Hysteria, and even had a member of Symposia on his show debating the merits of trashing me the way that they did. Still in denial that I had retired from my practice, the member of Symposia defended their actions by stating that they were informing women that they shouldn't work with me. All of this, on Symposia's part, was deeply unethical. They claim to be acting as investigative journalists, and the individual who wrote the original article and created the original video, has his degree in investigative journalism. I fail to see how editing and misrepresenting a popular video qualifies as either investigating or journalism. In weaponizing the video and completely misrepresenting the case against me, there was no case to represent, actually, as they were the ones making the accusations. Symposia clearly violated a number of tenets of ethical journalism that can easily be found online. These are not difficult to identify. Provide context. Take special care not to misrepresent or oversimplify. Identify sources clearly. Support the open and civil exchange of views. Avoid stereotyping. Never deliberately distort facts or context, including visual information. Show compassion for those who may be affected by news coverage. Deliberate distortion is never permissible. Make certain that headlines, news teases, and promotional material, photos, video, audio, graphics, sound bites, and quotations do not misrepresent. They should not oversimplify or highlight incidents out of context. Never distort the context of news, photos, or video. Image enhancement for technical clarity is always permissible. Label montages and photo illustrations. Analysis and commentary should be labeled and not misrepresent fact or context. Show good taste. Avoid pandering to lurid curiosity. Clarify and explain news coverage and invite dialogue with the public over journalistic conduct. Admit mistakes and correct them promptly. Expose unethical practices of journalists and the news media. Abide by the same high standards to which they hold others. Support the open exchange of views, even views they find repugnant. Personally, I think it is glaringly obvious that Symposia violated all of the principles of ethical journalism listed above. Have they been held accountable by the psychedelic community for these violations? No. In fact, they're more powerful and influential than ever. When all this took place, I went to the only platform I had, my podcast, and told my audience and whoever would listen that while I had never received any kind of negative feedback from any of my former clients along the lines Symposia was convincing everyone of, either when I was practicing or in the 5 years since I'd retired, I did want to invite anyone who had had a session with me who felt that they had been harmed or mistreated in any way to reach out to me to be heard, and that I would be willing to discuss their case publicly and anonymously if desired. Can you guess how many people I heard from? Not a single one. And how many of my former clients has Symposia heard from, thanking them for exposing my alleged horrific abuses? To my knowledge, not a single one. In our original communications, I asked Symposia if they would share with me any accounts from former clients they'd received so that I could consider what was brought to their attention in confirmation of their accusations, and nothing was ever forthcoming. So their characterization of me has received zero supporting evidence and also received numerous examples of counter-evidence, all of which Symposia ignored. And yet, for the most part, I've been exiled and abandoned by most of the psychedelic community. Even now, more than 2 years after Symposia's original smear campaign, I'm still told that I'm not welcome at conferences and events, and even in some cases where event organizers have told me that they feel I was unfairly represented and feel that I hadn't done anything wrong, my participation isn't welcome because either they're afraid of Symposia or don't want to attract negative attention and backlash from an online community that's been whipped into an irrational and indignant hysteria by Symposia. In other words, Symposia's efforts to get me canceled and deplatformed has largely worked. There are a few individuals out there who have gone to bat for me and invited me to participate in their events, either in person or online. But they are the exception. Here now, over 2 years out from the original onslaught, I'm still reminded almost daily of the reputational damage caused by Symposia. People send me messages telling me how people at conferences and events are trashing me from the stage or in conversations. I've recently had 3 offers to speak rescinded after, quote, concerns over your ethical violations have come to our attention, end quote. I've always been something of an outsider in the broader psychedelic community. I've challenged many assumptions and beliefs of various subsets within the psychedelic community, and my radical non-duality is uncompromising. I've made authentically expressing myself and sharing of my life, experiences, and perspectives a priority. This hasn't always won me friends and supporters. It's one thing for people to not like me or disagree with me. That comes with the territory of expressing views that go against the grain of accepted orthodoxy. But to be depicted as a psychopathic sexual predator and abuser, and to have this depiction accepted and repeated throughout the psychedelic world, is disappointing, to put it mildly. It's disappointing as it isn't true, and it's disappointing that the broader psychedelic community has basically come to accept Symposia's creation and clearly unethical conduct as being correct and acceptable and has largely responded with complacency. There are abusive people involved in the psychedelic community. I'm not one of them, never have been. But Symposia has created an environment that's so toxic that it's easier for people to just accept it and try to not get on their bad side, lest what they did to me and those who dared speak out in support of me happen to them. I think it's quite clear that Symposia is an abusive and unethical organization. And worse, large portions of the psychedelic community have appeared to respond to what Symposia did to me with the same logic that sometimes get applied to victims of sexual abuse, with comments that are analogous to, "Yes, but look what you were wearing." In this case, it would be, "Yes, but listen to what you said in that video." If Symposia had any integrity, they'd address all these issues and ethical violations. They'd admit to what they created and be upfront about wanting to make me look and seem as bad as possible, despite not finding any corroborating evidence of their judgments and stereotypes. They'd admit that they intentionally framed me and decontextualized what I shared and misled their audience about what I was sharing and why. They'd admit that they used me to go after Mark Hayden and then had such a great response from abusing me that they dug in for more, even while former clients were telling them that they were grossly distorting what working with me was like. And in the ideal world, the wider psychedelic community would demand these things from Symposia. But none of that has happened. In fact, the opposite has taken place. Symposia's decontextualized campaign of manufactured outrage against me has been taken up, copied, mirrored, and mimicked by others. Symposia's reporting has been taken as established proof of my wrongdoing, and their conclusions have been echoed and amplified by others. We live in an information environment where stories and information that generate strong negative emotions and responses get much wider distribution and a much larger audience than positive, neutral, or corrective stories. I've never had a large audience, And from the very beginning of Symposia's campaign, they were already starting with a much larger reach than myself. And as their work against me was specifically created to elicit strong negative reactions of disgust and disdain, they've been extremely effective in creating a condemned image of myself in the eyes of the larger world. They leveraged their inherent power imbalance against me, behaved in clearly unethical ways, and abused me for their own profit and gain. And it worked. For those who have followed my work and listened to my podcast, nothing I've shared here is new. I addressed all of this in 2021 on my podcast, and also with Rob on his show, and with the founders of LAMPS, who originally invited me to speak and made the video in question. However, my audience isn't as big as Symposia's, so their narrative has had far more reach than my response to their manufactured accusations. And when strong negative emotions are involved, it's challenging for people to shift into reasonable discourse and conversation, making it difficult for people to actually receive my response. Personally, I'm left in a surreal and bizarre split-screen double life situation. Wide swaths of the psychedelic public and establishment have written me off as an abuser where I am simply not welcome, and the view that I should be deplatformed and canceled is accepted, promoted, and supported. On the other hand, I'm routinely contacted by people who have read my books or actually listened to my lectures in full context, and I'm told that my work, insights, and views have transformed lives, revolutionized people's understanding of psychedelics, and people's understanding of the nature of reality and being. I'm told that I'm a breath of fresh air, a unique, irreplaceable, and invaluable voice, and that many consider my books and lectures to be truly mind-expanding and life-changing. For those who actually take the time to get to know me and my work, I'm thanked for being open, honest, vulnerable, and deeply authentic. Now, over 2 years out from Symposia's initial campaign, I get near daily reminders of both how much people appreciate me and how much people abhor and detest me. Because of the viral distribution of Symposia's narrative caricature of me, I never know when the other shoe is going to drop when I make a new contact or connection. At any moment, the "it has come to my our attention about your ethical abuses" could come in, which results in the closing of yet another opportunity. You'd never know it from Symposia and their imitators, but I'm a genuinely nice, open-hearted, compassionate person. Yes, I have a low tolerance for bullshit and woo-woo thinking, and I'm not afraid of speaking my mind, but I consider these attributes to be assets. Yet, my genuine bearing and personality is continually overshadowed by Symposia's distorted creation. Meanwhile, my actual day-to-day life is rather mundane and nothing like the picture Symposia created of me. Despite living with a chronic medical disorder, I do my best to make the most of each day and live to the fullest that I can. Other than working independently as a self-employed person, I spend the rest of my time with my wife and youngest son. We spend a lot of time in nature together, where my son has picked up my proclivity for nature and wildlife photography. We like to visit beautiful places together, and I like to document it all via photography and share it on my social media accounts. When I'm working, I'm creating music, art, writing, doing interviews for my podcast, and working with individuals from around the world as a non-dual entheogenic integration coach via video calls, where most of my clients comment that they've come to me because there's literally no one else I can talk to about this. Because I'm self-published as an author and self-produced as a musician, artist, and podcaster, I can never be completely canceled, as there will likely always be at least some who can see beyond the distorted caricature created and widely disseminated by Symposia. However, their abuse of me has had a widespread impact and undeniably severely limited my opportunities and possibilities. Just like Hester Prynne in Nathaniel Hawthorne's novel, The Scarlet Letter, I've been branded with a big A, though mine stands for abuser rather than adulterer. My ability to challenge the narrative created by Symposia has been minimal, and with the failure of the broader psychedelic community to hold Symposia accountable for their ethical violations and have their account of me accepted and reduplicated across other platforms and media, my number of allies is limited, as are my outlets. It's been 7 years since I retired from being a non-dual energetic practitioner. In the 5 years between the recording of the original LAMPS video and Symposia's campaign, this very popular video of me never inspired a backlash or generated outrage and condemnation. But ever since, I've been living with that scarlet letter. I'm not sure what the haters want from me, other than to disappear. The incongruence between public projection and my personal lived reality was highlighted by two recent events. One of the women mentioned in the original LAMPS video and extracted, highlighted, and distorted by Symposia, who I supposedly violated and abused, was recently in town and joined my family for our 4th of July barbecue and friend and family gathering. She didn't have a problem with me at the time of her session, and still doesn't today, well over a decade later, and is a family friend. The daughter of the older man mentioned in one of Symposia's extractions, who had been present as a witness for his session with me, and who had several of her own sessions with me, was over at my place just a few days ago to review a project she'd hired me for, and asked me if I'd come out of retirement to do another session with her because she prefers me and my methodology to all other options now available to her. She was appalled by Symposia's characterization of my work, and also has no desire to get involved at the public level, given the hysteria and high levels of projection around the whole thing. So, this is the bizarrely bifurcated reality I live in, all thanks to Symposia. I have no idea how to resolve any of this, or even if it can be resolved. For those who are actually curious to get to know me and what I've put out there and what I'm all about, it's quite easy to do, as my life is literally an open book. The first step is to look beyond the small fraction of what I've shared and has been repackaged and distorted by Symposia and their mimics. The original 3-hour video of me at LAMPS is still available. There are countless hours of my talks, lectures, presentations, and interviews available online. My weekly podcast features long, in-depth conversations with people from across the psychedelic spectrum, where I treat each person with warmth and respect. My books speak eloquently for themselves, and I'm always available to talk to anyone, and I'm always down for rational, civil conversation and discussion. Overall, I have an output of art, music, talks, writings, etc. that is prodigious. And throughout it all, I've sought to be open, honest, and vulnerable, sharing my successes, failures, my joys, my pains, and most of all, my humanity. If I could ask for one thing, it would be to be treated as the authentic human being that I am, not the caricature that Symposia has created. I imagine that most people would want the same, to be appreciated or not for who and what they actually are, and not some made-up and distorted fictional character. I've never expected everyone to like me or value what I share. I've taken risks in allowing myself to really authentically be and express myself, And from that, there's always bound to be some blowback, reactions, and projections. I can accept that. As I've shared in many places, authentically expressing yourself means you also need to be prepared to live with the consequences of the reactions of others. It comes with the territory of being authentic and not boxing oneself in to what others think we should be or performing in order to receive the approval and accolades of others. But being the target of public slander, character assassination, and deliberate distortion and emotional manipulation to manufacture public outrage and disgust, that shit just ain't cool. Moving forward and beyond symposia. I haven't addressed any of the specifics of what was shared in that original Lambs video here, as I've already addressed all of it, and instead have wanted to focus more on the context of what took place with symposia and the creation of their manufactured narrative. It is my hope that people can move beyond their emotional reactions and converse with measured reason. To that end, I'm happy to talk more about it, should people desire. But there comes a point where simply repeating myself becomes pointless. I'd like to move on. To that end, I could use more people in my life who have considered my case and come to the conclusion that there's no real issue here. There are no victims, and there is no abuse. And still, if there are previous clients of mine who feel that they need to be heard and have their case discussed publicly, then I invite that. Short of that, however, people who were not present in my sessions and have no first-hand knowledge of what took place have no real basis upon which to pass judgment of me or my practices or the views of my previous clients who have spoken out in support of me and their experiences with me. The accusations leveled against me by symposia are entirely unsubstantiated, and it would be helpful if the psychedelic community could acknowledge this. It is my position that the opinions of people who weren't there and weren't involved are just that, opinions. They aren't based on any direct knowledge or evidence, and they've been manipulated by symposia's unethical practices. I've been fortunate that there are a few individuals in the psychedelic community who have addressed this with integrity and have, despite protest and pushback, included me in their events and have sought to counter symposia's actions. For these brave individuals and organizations, I am deeply grateful. It's nice to have allies. It will take more, however, if the abuse of symposia and others who follow in their wake is to be overcome. Upon getting the full details of all of this, many people have suggested I sue symposia for defamation. The statute of limitations has already passed on that option. When all this originally took place, I naively hoped that rational conversation and analysis could diffuse the damage being inflicted by symposia. But clearly, that has not been the case, and they have successfully done great harm to my ability to speak, share, be of service, and make a living. When they decided to produce their third video of me using my session info PDF as a weapon against me, despite my having explicitly shared it with them confidentially and privately, their response was, "We checked with our lawyers," and excused their breach of trust thusly. My suspicion is that they take care to operate legally, though clearly not ethically. These are different domains of behavior. Just because something is illegal doesn't make it unethical, and just because something is legal doesn't make it ethical. I think my case makes it glaringly obvious that symposia is not concerned about holding themselves or their actions to any kind of ethical standard. And when I pointed this out to the investigative journalist who put his name on the original video and article, his response was, "How about holding those in power accountable?" Which indeed is one of the ethical guidelines of investigative journalism. But if all the other ethics of journalism are violated to hold up one, That's grossly selective and more of an excuse than anything else. When all of this originally happened, I invited the author and video producer to come on my podcast and defend himself concerning the obvious ethical lapses I identified, and he declined. Unlike myself, who is willing to speak to anyone on any platform about the accusations made by Symposia against me, they are unwilling to even enter into a conversation. To me, that speaks of cowardice, or perhaps it's just indifference. They don't actually care, and this whole holding abusers accountable thing is just a facade. When Lamps proposed we have a public conversation about all of this and invited the author and video producer to take part, Symposia insisted they would only do it if they could send others in his place as, quote, "we work as a team," which is a great excuse for avoiding personal accountability. Symposia would appear to be the institution giving support to ethical abusers, making sure they are not held accountable and using their organization to protect them when confronted by accusations of misconduct. I'll wrap all this up with a discussion of what Symposia and their imitators are apparently either unwilling or unable to try and understand. And this is the nature of the unconditioned state. Unless you've had a full non-dual experience, then you cannot even begin to contemplate just what the unconditioned state is. As the conditioned state is the state of being as filtered through the construct of the ego, which divides all experience into two fundamental categories of self and not-self, or other, i.e., duality. Furthermore, unless you've had a direct experience of the unconditioned state while experiencing 5-MeO-DMT, the world's most powerful entheogenic compound, then here too, you literally cannot conceive of what this experience is, what it entails, and how the human body can process and express it. Because of this exclusivity of knowledge and direct experience, one of my initial questions to members of Symposia, which they never bothered to answer, was whether any of them had direct experience with a full release dose of 5-MeO-DMT. They claim to be psychedelic watchdogs, but are they experienced with what they're supposedly policing? Because 5-MeO-DMT is a sui generis experience, no one who hasn't experienced it directly can possibly have anything meaningful to say about it. And this holds for anyone, even with ample experience with other entheogens. Anyone who wants to discuss what should or should not happen within the experience of 5-MeO-DMT either needs to be speaking from a place of direct personal experience or should be willing to withhold judgment, as you are not qualified to make any kind of meaningful commentary. In the conditioned, default, egoic state, the ego is constantly working to shape, edit, and structure one's experience and expression. This is what the ego does and how it functions. It is comprised of well-worn energetic pathways that create patterns of thought, expression, and action. It is built up from childhood and on into early adulthood as a person learns how and what to be. It is deeply influenced by family, education, religion, politics, culture, and one's relationships and interactions with others. It is strongly influenced by ideas of right and wrong, good and bad, appropriate and inappropriate, and all manner of value judgments, expectations, and permissions and withholdings. It is thoroughly conditioned. However, when one consumes a sufficiently large dose of 5-MeO-DMT, the energy of the entheogenic molecule completely overrides and temporarily suspends the conditioned state as embodied and expressed by the individual, which is precisely what allows moving into a full non-dual state of being. However, while the energetic pathways of the ego have been dissolved in this state, the condition of the human body is not itself overridden or suspended. In other words, the ego, the aspect of conditioned self-awareness, is not present, yet the full energy of being is now coursing through the structure of the human body. What this means is that the ecstatic energy of unconditioned being, which is best understood as unconditional love and full permission for authentic expression without censorship or preconceived structure, becomes expressed in the human body. This doesn't happen according to anyone's idea of what is right or wrong, good or bad, proper or improper, as it is raw, unfiltered, authentic expression of energy in the unconditioned state. Let's make this very visceral and dramatic. No one, for example, in their egoic mind, says to themselves, I'm going to go take a hit of 5-MeO-DMT and then strip off all my clothes and masturbate with ecstatic abandon in front of a group of strangers while screaming wildly at the top of my lungs. Or, I plan on vomiting all over myself after shoving my hands down my throat and then taking up the vomit and rubbing it all over my naked body while I writhe sensually and moan like I'm having the best sex of my life. To the uninitiated, the above descriptions might sound truly bizarre, and perhaps even horrifying. But for anyone who works with full-release 5-MeO-DMT, the above would fit within the category of perfectly normal. If your reaction to hearing this is, what the fuck? That's okay. It just means that you aren't educated about what the experience of 5-MeO-DMT can entail. And rather than reacting with disgust or judgment, you can use it as an opportunity to educate yourself and learn. When in the unconditioned state, what happens, as expressed through the structures of the human body, is not what anyone thinks should or should not happen. In contrast, what happens is what needs to happen, because that is how the energy is expressing and being embodied without the energetic confines of the human ego being present to edit, censor, or control it. Now, imagine, if you will, being able to work with someone who is not only intimately familiar with this unconditioned energetic state of being, but has processed his way through it to the degree that he can open up to this level of intensity, yet not react and also remain present and attentive. This person is not working through the confines of the egoic structure, is not thinking about right or wrong or should or shouldn't, but rather is attending to the authentic expression and embodiment of energy as it arises, and is able to be balanced, poised, and focused while in this state. Now, let's take it even a step further. Not only is this person able to work from this state, but is able to work with you directly when you are in this state, encountering yourself as the unconditioned energy of God, here, now, directly in your body. And because no egos are present, there is no sense of separation, no sense of duality, no sense of me versus not me, as everything fits perfectly into the infinite nature of unitary being. There is no longer two distinct people here, but one being interacting with itself through the vehicles of two distinct yet energetically entwined bodies. One of them is processing the enormity and awesomeness of this experience, and processing and letting go of all restrictive energetic pathways. And the other is neutrally embodying the fullness of the energy and attending to the energetic process of the other as and when necessary, as energy demands. The entire event, though completely unplanned, unstructured, and undirected, proceeds exactly as it needs to, and energy is expressed and embodied authentically all the way through, and might even be perceived by an observer as a perfectly choreographed event, despite being purely spontaneous. This is far more of an accurate description of what sessions were like with me than anything produced by Symposia. This is why I called it non-dual energetic therapy. And this is why it most certainly was not psychedelic therapy in any conventional sense as promoted by MAPS or any other psychedelic therapy program. When Symposia told the world the materials from my talk was, quote, advice for psychedelic therapists. They were either cynically lying to their audience or simply not curious or intelligent enough to grasp that what I was talking about was something fundamentally different from what anyone conceives of as psychedelic therapy. Non-dual energetic therapy is not psychedelic therapy, though it does make use of psychedelics. And I was the only person in the world offering this kind of work. It was fundamentally unique and not comparable to anything else. In crafting their narrative, Symposia was trying to impose the egoic conditions of what, quote, psychedelic therapy should be onto a practice that wasn't even remotely within that category of practice. A curious, open mind might ask, so what is this non-dual energetic therapy and what's actually going on here? Symposia never bothered to ask that question and made sure that their audience didn't as well by purposefully activating a response of disgust and horror, which makes it extremely difficult for the rational mind to process and think clearly. For those who are willing to look beyond surface appearances, there is a profound and revolutionary depth to what I have to share and offer the world. There is a reason that many of my listeners and readers respond to my work with comments that they've never seen or heard anything like what I'm sharing, because that's just a basic fact. My ability to articulate what's going on and why and how to work with these unconditioned states is simply unparalleled and cannot be found anywhere else. This is why so many comment that I am a fundamentally unique voice, not only in the world of psychedelics, but also of non-duality. This is also precisely why I can be so difficult for the uninitiated to understand or relate to, and why I can appear as shocking. The ego, the conditioned self, is not able to understand how the unconditioned self works, expresses itself, and is embodied. This is because all understanding is filtered through the structures of the conditioned self, aka the ego. Working with non-dual energy should be challenging and difficult to understand or appreciate simply because it operates beyond and outside of the structures of the ego. So, yeah, weird shit happens, and it can be difficult to understand, appreciate, or contextualize. Simply falling into that's abuse, however, is a complete intellectual cop-out. For the truly and genuinely curious, there's a great deal to be learned here, and especially with the examples I've given that have gotten me into so much trouble via Symposia. I, obviously, never thought of any of it as abuse, nor did my clients. The fact that not a single former client of mine has come forward to agree with Symposia's character of me, and in fact have done the opposite, should suggest to the curious that there's a different way to appreciate all of this. Yet, there is no prior frame of reference. There's nothing really to compare it to. My practice wasn't psychedelic therapy. It wasn't shamanism. It wasn't ceremony. It wasn't holding space. It wasn't anything that people normally think of in terms of the context of working with powerful psychedelic molecules. It was something profoundly different. And it was precisely this profound difference that brought my clients coming back time and again for more of what they couldn't find anywhere else with anyone else. And this is precisely why context was so important for what Symposia distorted by de- and recontextualizing. They repeatedly failed to even attempt to accurately describe what the context was, and instead thoroughly recontextualized it as something it obviously wasn't. This uniqueness is why, when people encounter my lectures, they tend to view as many as they can find, because I'm not speaking like anyone else in the field, and the information I'm imparting is fundamentally different and unique. It's the same reason why people like to buy not just one, but many of my books. There's unique, profound, different information in there that you're not going to find elsewhere. This is why so many of my integration clients choose to work with me to help them unpack and integrate their entheogenic experiences, because I'm able to offer them reflection and understanding and deep knowledge that they feel they can't find elsewhere. And I agree with them. So, yes, I can be difficult to understand. I can be shocking. I can be challenging. I'm known for bursting bubbles and not tolerating bullshit. I speak clearly and mean what I say. I share openly because I feel there's value in that. I'm honest and straightforward because I have nothing to hide and everything to share. But thanks to Symposia, in the eyes of the wider psychedelic world, I'm canceled, blackballed, blacklisted, exiled, shunned, tossed aside, thrown out, shut out, all because I'm an abuser of their making. If someone dispassionately considers all the evidence and the full context and still reaches that conclusion and holds that opinion, then so be it. There really isn't anything more I can do or say. It is my deep hope, however, that more people can take a look beyond the caricature and character assassination, dig deeper, think more openly, and perhaps genuinely see. Maybe then we can have a real conversation about it. Until then, I'll continue to be myself, produce my podcast, books, art, music, photographs, and share and speak when allowed and afforded the opportunity by those who are brave and seek to act with integrity. To state again, all I ask is what I think everyone would hope for themselves. See me for who and what I actually am, not some manufactured stereotype. If you want to get to know me, I'm right here. I'm available. I'm open. I'm willing. My output is voluminous, and the contributions I've made to the psychedelic movement are vast and have so much more worth and value than being boiled down to a few comments from a video from 7 years ago that were themselves in reference to experiences that occurred spontaneously years before. It's up to the broader psychedelic movement and community, however, to either willingly support and accept unethical journalism and character assassination, or stand up to it and hold the abusers accountable and take a stand for truth, accuracy, and fairness. If the psychedelic community wants to go along with cancel culture and cynically reducing complex individuals to viral hit jobs and smear campaigns, there's nothing I can do about that. That won't stop me from hoping and wanting more, however. And it's in this hope that I'm choosing to share all of this again. Is anyone else willing to step up and demand more? Or is this the culture that people genuinely want?